All right, welcome to the first ever edition of the We the People version of the weekend show, Truth Jihad Radio. My name's Kevin Barrett. I've been working for We the People for a while now, and we've decided to move the show over to the weekend. So this is it. This is the beginning of hopefully what will be something big. And, hey, we're going to have some great shows for you this weekend, the opening shot here of Truth Jihad Radio and its new weekend slot features some of the most important scholars working on the 9/11 case, which, of course, as you all know, is the case that I've been focused on over my year and a half as a talk radio host here at We the People and elsewhere. The folks I'll be bringing on this weekend, they're all reasonably well-known, but, of course, none better known than tomorrow's guest, David Ray Griffin, the author of The New Pearl Harbor, the book that probably more than any other book blew the 9/11 case wide open. And some other very serious scholars are going to join us today and tomorrow, folks who have done the kind of painstaking scholarly work that Dr. Griffin has done, but who aren't maybe quite as well known yet. Well, one reason is that the guests I'll be bringing on today, one of them tomorrow, along with Dr. Griffin, are contributors to a book that was extremely pricey when it first came out. And that book, of course, is The Hidden History of 9/11, edited by Paul Seremka, who is a University of New York at Buffalo professor. Now, this book was published by a leading academic publications outfit in Europe. In fact, I believe it's the leading scholarly publisher in Europe, JAI Press, which is an imprint of Elsevier. And when this book came out, it did affect the thinking of people in academia on 9/11. But it didn't really get as big a public reaction as some of the other 9/11 books have. As I said, because it was extremely expensive in the hardcover European edition, so hardly anybody could afford to buy it. Well, I have some good news for you. It's out in paperback, reasonably priced, $20, a bargain at twice the price. The Hidden History of 9/11 includes some of the most important essays that have yet been written about 9/11. Careful scholarly work in all cases. And it does bring us up to date about where we are now in our knowledge of what went down on September 11, 2001. So the folks I'll be interviewing today are the editor, Paul Seremka, who is also a contributor to the volume. He wrote the preface, and he's got a couple of other chapters. He focused especially on the insider trading issues, and he's attempted to evaluate the big picture of what we know. What are the various possibilities about what might have happened that day? Because I think we can all agree that we don't really know what happened. We're still trying to piece it together. But one thing that we do know is that the official story that they've given us is a crock. It's been disproven on so many fronts and questioned on so many others that it has long since collapsed under its own weight. And for those who are not yet aware of this or who would like to see the details proving it, you can't really do better than this volume, The Hidden History of 9/11. Now, today, so we're going to be talking with Paul Seremka, the editor and contributor of a couple of articles. And we're also going to be talking about Brian Sachs. He's the author of an article in this book entitled Making History, The Compromised 9/11 Commission. And I think it's about the best thing written on the 9/11 Commission other than David Ray Griffin's fantastic full-length volume, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. If you want the short version of why the 9/11 Commission was really the 9/11 Cover-Up Commission, you can get that from the Brian Sachs article, Making History, the Compromised 9/11 Commission. It's only 35 or so pages, unlike Dr. Griffin's book. So it can kind of give you that that overview, along with the key details. And some of the key details are just almost stuff you couldn't dream up. A Hollywood scriptwriter couldn't make it look worse than some of this stuff. Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, was the most ridiculous individual to pick to have that body that anybody could ever think of. You know, they thought Henry Kissinger was bad. Philip Zelikow, the close Bush administration associate member of the transition team, close associate of Condoleezza Rice, author of an article in Foreign Affairs discussing the likely cultural and psychological consequences of a massive Pearl Harbor-style terrorist attack such as the destruction of the World Trade Center. Where could you ever come up with somebody more inappropriate to have this commission? Not only that, but Dr. Zelikow is a specialist in what he calls the creation and maintenance of public myth. He defines public myth as a guiding or shaping understanding of events that may not be true, but it's at least believed to be true. And he's especially focused on what he calls searing events that mold an entire generation. Events like Pearl Harbor and the Great Depression and, of course, 9/11. Well, he wrote that before 9/11. He wrote his article discussing the likely psychological, cultural, and political consequences of 9/11 before 9/11. So this is the guy they hired to oversee the quote-unquote investigation. And the book he produced, 9/11 Commission Report, is charitably described as a good page-turner of a novel. But the contents are deeply, deeply suspect in so many ways. Proof of omissions, and I call them lies, not just distortions, but out-and-out lies. They're difficult to enumerate, although you can always focus on whatever you think are the biggest ones. So we'll be talking with Brian Sachs in the second hour of today's show about the deeply flawed 9/11 Commission report, and perhaps also about what it's going to take to get a new investigation that would actually subpoena witnesses, put them under oath, grill them, and get at the truth, offer them immunity from prosecution. This is what real investigations do. And it won't be that hard to clear this thing up once that process gets started, because the researchers who have sparked the 9/11 truth movement have already come up with so much information that half the prosecutor's work has already been done for them. So I anticipate an investigation that will knock the whole thing over like a row of dominoes. How that investigation will be set up, when it will occur, we don't know yet, but we certainly have to keep pushing for it. Well, I've gotten word that my first guest, Paul Zaremka, editor of The Hidden History of 9/11, is on the line. He's a professor of economics at SUNY Buffalo, that's State University of New York, Buffalo. He's been the general editor of Research in Political Economy, the author of Towards the Theory of Economic Development, and he has the honor of having edited this, perhaps the most important scholarly collection of writing on 9/11. So, hey, it's an honor to welcome Paul Zaremka. How are you, Paul?
Thank you. Yes, I'm fine.
Hey, it's great to have you. You know, I'm so happy your book is finally out in an affordable edition, and we'll be getting the recognition that it has long deserved. Congratulations on that. Was it tough getting it published in paperback?
It wasn't that tough. It just took a little bit of more time than I expected. But we're really pleased with this publisher, which is Seven Stories Press. You may know it, but it's one of the major independent bookstores in New York City. It's also a progressive bookstore. So, and they did a wonderful job and were supportive all the way along. So we're really happy with them.
Great. Well, they did a great job in getting those books to us here in Wisconsin in time for the Bob Bowman event this past week. And I appreciate that. They had to go out of their way. And it's really a very impressive collection. How did you start work on this? What led you to investigating 9/11 and editing this important book on it?
Well, actually, my own start on 9/11, I mean, the day of 9/11 itself, of course, like many other people, I was phoned to go to the TV and watch what was transpiring, and I didn't have, I more or less absorbed what was happening and terrified with what was happening, but didn't have a take on, you know, on who did it. I didn't even think in those terms. I was just absorbing the event itself. And it was about 3 or 4 months later that I started to begin to get more interested in what might be behind it. And then Michael Rupert had a talk in Toronto, which showed the real version of the Zapruder film, which showed Kennedy's head being shot from the front instead of the rear, and he showed it over and over again. And I realized that I really had to understand 9/11 much more seriously. So I wound up basically doing web research mostly for the until about October of 2002, and then I published in the meantime, I guess one of the volumes, volume 20 of the research in political economy, where we had confronting 9/11 as one of the topics, one of the first two chapters. But it wasn't directly about investigating 9/11, but it was still opening up the question about 9/11. And I had my own preface in there, which was asking the questions that I was asking myself about what really happened on 9/11. And what was interesting is, maybe we'll talk about this later, is that I missed the fact that there was three buildings that fell on the World Trade Center instead of two. I didn't know that
at that
point.
A lot of people did. Believe it or not, there's still some people who are missing it.
Right. what happened was that there was some, I don't really know how it happened, but about 40 faculty members of one sort or another from various parts of the country and maybe some other countries, began to communicate about 9/11 among each other. I don't know how I got on the list, maybe because of this, this volume of the research. And somebody suggested doing a book, and to make the long story short, because I'm editor of this series, I offered the possibility of becoming the editor of a collected works. And there were some wrinkles along the way, but basically what happened is it really gelled in the final publication, which came out in 2006.
And
that takes you up to the hardback, huh?
Great. Yeah, the publisher of the hardcover edition, the JAI Press, as I understand, they're a very respected academic publisher in Europe.
Yeah, well, it's actually not so much JAI Press. It's a JAI imprint, but it's Elsevier, which is the sort of one of the top two or three academic publishers in the world.
Well, it's interesting that this book would be put out by such a prestigious publisher, and yet, in American academia, there are so many people who are completely oblivious to the contents of this book and who are unthinkingly and uncritically accepting the official story. And yet, of course, none of them will dare to debate those of us who question the official story. Why do you think it's taken so long for academics to wake up to this information?
That's a hard question. I mean, there is a history of academics not being too much on the ball many times. I mean, for example, in Nazi Germany, there was a lot of academics that fell under the sway of Nazism. I'm not saying that's happening in the United States, but I'm just saying that academics are so individualistic and sometimes very career-oriented that they fear these kinds of topics as damaging their career. And actually, they're not misplaced in that thought.
Well, yeah, I guess I learned that the hard way myself.
Yes, you did.
Although, you know, it's this talk radio host stuff is a pretty interesting career, too. In fact, I'm actually getting a better education than I was poring over academic volumes in the university library by bringing on folks like you.
Right.
So you've devoted particular attention to studying certain aspects of 9/11, such as insider trading. And that's a question that has been studied from different angles. And what do we now know about the alleged insider trading that happened on 9/11?
Well, what we know and what is still buried is probably a wide gap.
What we know is still buried. Yeah. Right.
But what I want to say is that, I mean, this is one of the things that happened after 9/11 that led to a major mainstream press articles that there was a huge amount of insider put option trading going on toward American Airlines and United Airlines, because those were the two flying companies involved, which suggested a substantial foreknowledge of what was going to happen before it happened, and people were trying to take advantage of that financially. However, the reports went for about a month and a half in places, and even prestigious places like Barron's, the mainstream financial publication, and suddenly this dropped off the radar. I mean, just nobody was talking about it anymore. And I kind of had the feeling that somebody told them to shut up.
Well, it certainly wasn't that they resolved the issue.
It wasn't that they resolved the issue. I think what happened is that, I mean, if you can get information on put option purchases and various financial data, which an independent person who has no connection to anything can just get it. And they noticed these large put option trades, and they guessed, frankly, that bin Laden must have done it. And they thought that all we had to do was find out who did those put options. It would turn out to be bin Laden, and that would be the end of the ballgame. And we would have definitive proof that he was behind it. Some of the people who were doing that, I mean, came out of Israel. Some of them came out of the United States. But I think they were all kind of taken aback by their own ability to see where things could lead if you follow the money.
Okay, I'm sure they were, because as the 9/11 Commission told us, they didn't find any link to bin Laden in those put options. And so we didn't worry about it. It wasn't bin Laden. Don't look any further, folks. Move along. All right, we'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Derrick with Paul Zaremka right here on Truthy Head Radio. Welcome back to the brand new weekend edition of Truthy Head Radio, with brand new bumper music, some of it at least, and some great guests. This first weekend, we are bringing on some of the most important contributors to scholarly work on 9/11, beginning with the editor of the brand new paperback edition of The Hidden History of 9/11. That is Paul Zaremka, professor at SUNY Buffalo. And Paul, we were just talking a little bit about the put options, one of the great red flags in the whole 9/11 affair. And another issue that you touch on briefly in this book is the issue of the enormous and enormously suspicious profits realized by Larry Silverstein, who privatized and took control of the World Trade Center shortly before 9/11. And as you say, you describe his generous insurance coverage, which stopped lease payments on 9/11/01. But not the high compensation for supposed loss. What that means is he put down a little over $100 million for his first payment on this 99-year lease for the World Trade Center complex. And then when the buildings, these asbestos-ridden white elephant buildings with lousy antiquated communications equipment and low vacancy rates were destroyed on 9/11, he ended up walking away with a lump sum of $4.5 billion in insurance money, a couple more billions in some other form of money, and now he's asking for $11 billion more. This is pushing towards $15 billion-plus in pure profit on a six-week investment. Do you find it as scandalous as I do that the media, such as the New York Times, has never even pointed the slightest finger at the insanely suspicious nature of Silverstein's purchase, insurance coverage, and insurance settlement?
Yeah, it's sure it's scandalous, but there's so many things that are scandalous about what is not covered about 9/11. Kevin, I actually wasn't finished on the put options.
Let's go back to the put options, because we're talking about financial aspect of this scam.
Because I did want to make a point here. The point is that it turns out that some of the initial investigators who had reported data about how much put option trading was going on were a little bit exaggerating the order of 2-1. In other words, they had seemingly added both the sale and the purchase side together instead of making it as one transaction. They doubled the transaction. And that was not consistent with the actual data that eventually got reported. But what is even more important is that a professor at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, namely Potasman, published an article in 2006 on his scientific investigation of whether there was exaggerated put option purchases before 9/11. And it was totally a scientific work, and it was even done with data that the public cannot get. In other words, he got data which actually reported the levels of put option trades purchase of put options independently of the sales of put options. Now, that's a complicated distinction, which I can't get into today. But anyway, he got independent data, and the bottom line is he did scientific research of a statistical nature, which published in a journal of business. You can't do much better than that in terms of peer review. And the result was, like, with 99% probability, there was definitely insider trading on 9/11, before 9/11, sorry.
Well, that's interesting. And, of course, The mainstream media didn't seem to pick up on that and reopen this
right.
question.
It did not lead anybody that I know about to say, we better check this out more carefully. There are two researchers in the University of Zurich who don't have the private data but are doing what is available with the public data along the lines of what Otis Mann is doing and are actually confirming his results. And these are not published yet, but that's the direction of their conclusions. That's one of the differences between the hardcover edition of the book and the softcover, because in the softcover edition coming out 2 years later than the hardcover, I could pull up updated information.
That's right. And that's another reason to get this version beyond the fact that it doesn't cost an arm and a leg anymore.
Right. I mean, you can get it for less than $14 on Amazon, for example.
Really?
Not bad.
Yeah, well, I would urge people to get this. It's, as I said, I think that this is at the very top of the heap of, especially the scholarly work on 9/11 has genuinely scholarly. This is very, very careful work. In your consideration of the various scenarios of questions of how, for example, the question of whether there were hijackings, remote piloted airliners or plane switches, that you've been very careful in considering the alternatives and really sticking with what you can document.
That's right.
So getting to the financial aspects what more can you say about Larry Silverstein? This is completely outrageous what he's gotten away with so far.
That's right.
Let's move on to your take on some of these questions of how it might have been done. Generally, most people agree that as far as telling the general public that we have a problem with this case, we should pretty much stop and say, look, we can't really prove what happened, but we can certainly prove that what the official story tells us happened did not happen. And speculating about what might have happened often does lead to acrimonious divisions among 9/11 researchers who get carried away perhaps with their own imagination or their own egos invested in whatever they personally think happened. But when you consider those possibilities of hijackings, suicide hijackings, hijackings with remote control, maybe override remote control, or drones, you ended up sort of coming down in favor slightly of the second alternative. Is my reading correct?
The second being?
The probability of actual hijacking with remote control override guiding the plane to their target.
Okay, yes, I would say that's correct. I mean, first of all, for people in the 9/11 research movement, some people have even claimed that the planes did not even take off. I mean, the planes that everybody talks about didn't even take off. And I think that's just not correct. I mean, I think the evidence, the lack of counter evidence and the evidence that some people have offered that the planes didn't take off, I think is not credible.
Right. Well,
I think the planes really did take off.
Right. There's some, like Elias Davidson, who argues that there's no evidence that these passengers ever got on the plane. Took off, specifically with the bizarre lack of the security videos, the official passenger list, the boarding passes, and testimony from the airline personnel who would have boarded these people.
Well, I don't agree with that.
The hijackers.
The hijackers is another story. I'm talking about the regular passengers.
Okay.
We don't have evidence of anybody or the families of the people who died. We don't have evidence, for example, that they called their families ahead of time saying, no, I'm not going on that plane, I'm going on another plane, or this or that is happening. As far as I know, there's no evidence that the people who are most, I'm not talking about the hijackers now, alleged hijackers, sorry. I'm not talking about them, I'm talking about everybody else, that they really did die, and furthermore, they didn't give anybody any evidence that they weren't on the planes that they have been ascribed to have been on. And furthermore, we have flight data information which suggests that the planes took off. And I just don't, you know, the rest is speculation as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, well, I agree with you, Paul. I haven't seen any convincing evidence that the planes didn't take off either.
Right, but I do want to get back to the hijackers, though.
Okay, we'll get back to the question of hijackers in the next segment. This is Kevin Durant. Right. I'm talking with Paul Zaremka. We'll be right back on Truth Jihad Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Durrett, running this Truth Jihad right through to as long as it takes to get this door open to the truth of what happened on 9/11 and so many other similar events that have marred the history of the USA. And my guest is Paul Zaremka of the University of Buffalo, the University of New York at Buffalo. He's the editor of the Hidden History of 9/11, and we're talking right now about the questions of what might have really happened on 9/11. Always a somewhat speculative and occasionally divisive topic, but so far we're pretty much in agreement. And Paul, as far as what's now known about the 9/11 alleged hijackers, which is the subject of a chapter in your book by Jay Kolar, who will be my guest tomorrow in the second hour after David Griffin comes on during the first hour, what's your take on these questions that have been raised about what was actually going on with these alleged 19 hijackers?
Okay, I don't want to cut in too much into what Jay Kolar will tell you tomorrow because he's the expert. But what we do know is that about 10 of the hijackers stood up somewhere in the world and said, "I'm alive," after 9/11, okay? And there's also the case of Jara, who's the pilot of Flight 93, which crashed in Pennsylvania, which suggests that he had a double, that wasn't really him on that plane. But anyway, Jay can talk about that more. What I want to talk about, though, is what might have happened on that day. My evidence suggests, and I'm not as sure, I'm not 100% sure of this, but I'm convinced enough that there was somebody on the planes doing something to try and take control of the pilots, of the planes from the pilots. However, that doesn't really say very much. I mean, it's kind of surprising, but it doesn't tell you very much because if you're hijacking a plane, you could be told to hijack the plane for some nefarious purpose, which has nothing to do with what happened the rest of the day on 9/11. And furthermore, there may be only one person knew a larger plan of who was ever on the planes, and the other three or four did not, okay? And furthermore, we don't even know the identities of these individuals. So I went sort of back, I sort of rewound the reel and tried to think, if you are trying to organize a conspiracy to bring down those planes onto the towers and the Pentagon or wherever else you wanted to do, you're dealing with four planes which have schedules. The schedules are not exactly at the same time. I mean, they're actually up to 25 minutes apart. And furthermore, if you're planning something on a commercial airline, you don't really know that the plane's actually going to take off because planes are canceled. And you don't know the planes aren't going to be delayed on the runway. So you're in trouble if you're trying to plan a whole operation around a hypothetical takeoff time, which may not occur. And in fact, one of the planes in New York was about 25 minutes delayed in its takeoff.
That was Flight 93, wasn't it?
That's Flight 93, exactly. Right. So I asked myself the question, let's suppose you are planning this operation. Would you really, I mean, truly, would you rely on some guy taking over the plane and committing himself all the way to the destruction of a building? I mean, you're going to do this. This is really important operation. Would you really want a human being to be in control who might lose his nerve at the last minute?
All right. So, if you got these buildings rigged up for demolition, you need to have a plane crash to blame the demolition on. So you'd have to make sure that some planes hit those buildings.
Right. I can talk later about the issue of demolition. There's also other possibilities, at least one other possibility of a collapse that wouldn't be demolition. But anyway, I don't want to get to that right now. What I want to just get to is that the other two possibilities are that you have the planes guided into the towers by some kind of electronic computer process similar to the way a pilot takes lands in many of the landings at any airport. And almost all of us have had guided landings of planes that we've been on. I mean, that's actually the traditional way in which you guide a plane into it. So that you're on a beam, you follow the beam down to the runway. Suppose you change the beam and the beam goes to the World Trade Center, for example. That is a second possibility, and that possibility, if you can also eliminate the possibility of the pilots being able to take control of the plane, that's a second way to accomplish the objective, and it's more reliable than relying upon a human being.
That's for sure.
So that's when you said before that I sort of am biased in that direction. I am biased in that kind of operation, but at the same time, we don't have concrete proof of that, but we don't have concrete proof that the hijacker stayed in the pilots and piloted the planes in the towers either. Anybody who tells you that, you can't, I mean, everybody just assumes that the pilot got on that the alleged hijacker got into the cockpit of the plane and just stayed there and flew the plane to the target. But you don't know that. I mean, nobody knows that.
One of the reasons people jump to that conclusion is that there has been a concerted effort by the media, even pre-9/11, to cast Arabs and Muslims as crazed, suicide-bent fanatics who love to blow themselves up and crash into things.
Yes.
Of course, that's complete nonsense. Robert Tape's study, Dying to Win, the Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, is the best study of the subject, and he shows that there's absolutely no connection whatsoever, statistical or otherwise, between Muslims and Islam and, you know, Arabs and terrorism. It's purely a case of when people's countries are invaded and occupied, then those people, whether they're religious or not, whatever their religion or non-religion, they fight back with suicide terrorism. The world's leading terrorist outfit is the secularist Hindu group, the Tamil Tigers, and yet our media keeps brainwashing us into thinking that Arabs and Muslims are crazy people who are anticipating virgins in the afterlife, so they'll do any darn thing. And I think that racism, that obscene level of bigotry, more than anything else, has led Americans to assume that this was a crime of Arab and Muslim hijackers.
Well, you know, that's one of the big advantages of this volume that has just been published, because one of our articles is exactly on Islamophobia by Diana Rolfe at the University
right.
of Ottawa.
Right.
And, I mean, that's really an excellent chapter, and it goes back to connections between the United States and the Likud government earlier, and creating an environment where Islamophobia festers. So one of the things I like about this volume is that we don't just stop on what happened in 9/11. We look at background elements of what happened.
Right. That's a great essay.
Right. That particular essay has been reproduced by the editor of 9/11blogger.com. He posted it there, which is that's the only chapter. Actually, there's two chapters that are available online. That chapter is available online at 9/11blogger.com, and also the chapter by Four Arrows, who has Native American background. We haven't been talking about that, but his chapter is available on 9/11physics.net. But other than that, you have to buy the book if you want to read it.
And now that it only costs less than $20, it's worth doing.
Yeah.
Don Jacobs or Four Arrows, his article on the military drills is pretty interesting. You know, building on past work by people like Mike Rupert, Barbara Heinegger, and Webster Tarpley. And again, you know, when you add it all up and try and figure out what it all means, it's not necessarily easy, but yeah, your guesses so far sound pretty reasonable, although I would imagine we would have some issues on the demolition question. I'm pretty convinced that happened, but before we do that, let's quickly bring in a caller. It's Chris calling in from Oklahoma. Welcome, Chris. How's it going?
Good, Kevin. Congratulations on your new time slot. Look forward to, in fact, I'm listening to you on the air here in Oklahoma City. I had a question for your guest, and I just came on late onto the show here. I was talking to Kevin Ryan some time ago, and we found out through various sources on the Internet and some reputable colleagues that the planes that crashed into the towers coincidentally hit the floors, that both floors on the separate buildings had the uninterrupted power supply units on both those floors. They were actually unoccupied. And wanted to see if your guest had any comment. I'll listen on the other side of the break. So,
okay. Thanks for the question, Chris. Okay, we'll be back after the break with an answer for that excellent question. The floors that got hit just happened to be unoccupied where the power supply units were. Another of these coincidences, or is there some meaning to this? Well, we'll be back with Paul Zaremka, editor of the Hidden History of 9/11, to address that in just a moment. Welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio in its brand new time slot. That's right, we're on the weekends now, 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm celebrating this inaugural weekend of Truth Jihad Radio's new time slot by interviewing some of the most important scholars working on the 9/11 case. And right now we're talking with Paul Zaremka, the editor of The Hidden History of 9/11. In the next hour, we'll bring on Brian Sachs, a contributor to that volume, the author of an article critiquing the 9/11 Commission report. So, Paul, our caller, Chris from Oklahoma, wondered about this coincidence uncovered by Kevin Ryan, that the floors that these planes hit were empty, the sites of generating equipment.
Well, first of all, Kevin Ryan, I just made a comment that Kevin Ryan does have a piece in the new edition, in the software edition, that wasn't in the hardcover edition, and I'm really pleased to have included him. He's the editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And I also know he's just a very solid human being. But anyway, that aside, Chris, I didn't hear that before. That's new information. That's kind of new information that's surfacing, you know, frequently, and we have to take account of it. I just didn't know it.
Okay. And you, so
it's important information. I didn't know it.
Okay. All right. Now, yeah, as far as the significance of that, I guess the fact that so much of the World Trade Center was unoccupied did give people a chance to have, you know, gave the perpetrators access to perhaps plant explosives or other, you know, demolition equipment. And that leads us to the question, you said that you had some alternative to demolition as an explanation of what happened in the World Trade Center. What could that be?
Well, I don't have an explanation alternatively. Let me just say this, that there was a professor whose name I forgot in Holland, who's an expert on demolition. They showed him videos of the World Trade Centers going down, and I think the World Trade Center 7 also. I'm not quite sure if it was all three of them or just two of them.
I think it was just Building 7, I remember.
Just Danny, Building 7.
Danny Chewenko is a top European demolition expert.
And he didn't know what was being shown to him, and he immediately identified it as the demolition, which I think is really striking, because it's really the propaganda that it's not a demolition that leads people to think that it's not a demolition. It's not what they would ordinarily think on their own. In fact, even news broadcasters, when it initially happened, said it was a demolition. So the bias definitely is in the direction of demolition rather than the government's explanation. But having said that, I just have to report the fact that there are people out there who think that it's even more advanced technology than simple demolition, that it might have been a directed energy operation. I'm no expert, but I'm just saying that there is.
Okay, I got you. Yeah, that's a matter of terminology. I didn't realize that's what you were referring to, but I think it's simpler to just talk about demolition and leave open the question of precisely how the demolition was accomplished. Because in whatever was done to these buildings, the three skyscrapers at least, they did come straight down. They disappeared at roughly freefall speed. They were symmetrical. They had all of these classic, 10 exclusive characteristics of controlled demolitions. So whatever techniques were being used to destroy these buildings, the result was controlled demolition of one kind or another.
Or you could say controlled collapse, of which controlled demolition would be one subset of two or three or more possibilities of a controlled collapse. I mean, if I use the word demolition, everybody has in mind putting charges inside the building, right? And that's, I guess that's, I'm a little bit concerned about muddying the waters like that. If there's an alternative explanation which doesn't involve putting charges in the building, but does it some other way, we shouldn't use the word demolition.
I see. So have you actually studied these directed energy?
No. I mean, the reason why it came into my attention is first of all, after this book came out, I was pointed to it. I did know about it before, but I got more attention to it than I had before. But also, coincidentally, there was a TV program about a week ago on Tesla. And this is, you know, the guy who worked on, he worked on death rays and lighting. I can't remember the whole story about it. But
remote control electricity, zapping light bulbs on from without a wire from a distance.
Right. He's an amazing guy, a very eccentric guy at the same time. But we're talking 1910s, 1920s, that kind of period. And in the middle of this program, they said that he had a device which would cause vibrations in a tower. He was in Manhattan, and he caused vibrations in a building in Manhattan, which was so strong that the building was threatened to collapse until somebody came into his office and broke the machine. He couldn't turn off the machine. Somehow the switch didn't work. And so somebody smashed the machine to keep it from happening. But if we're talking 80 years ago, that something like that could have happened. I mean, what's possible today?
Well, that's a good point. And that is why I ask people not to completely shut down the possibility that different advanced technologies could have been used on 9/11. Since we know it was a government inside job of one kind or another, it's certainly conceivable that government agencies and quasi-government private entities, all these privatized national security firms that Rumsfeld created, might have applied some advanced techniques to this. And, you know, so many people in the 9/11 truth movement don't want to go there because talking about anything that's speculative and science fiction-y sounding is thought to discredit the 9/11 truth movement. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, I'm not at the level yet of, quote, going there. I'm at the level of only opening up the possibility of, you know, saying, let's be truthful. There are people out there that are going in that direction, and we shouldn't just dismiss. We shouldn't just say they're crazies. I mean, that's what is done by the government to the people who think that the people inside the United States were behind 9/11. We can't go there. We have to do it scientifically. We have to do it carefully and in a reasoned manner. And that goes for various interpretations of what actually caused the buildings to collapse.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. That's actually the root of my recent disagreement with Jim Fetzer, who has been recently championing the video fakery hypotheses that the videos of the plane crashes at the towers were fake. And my problem with him is not so much that he's exploring that hypothesis, but that his means of exploring it does not have the careful kind of balanced kind of format that is going to make it possible for people to judge whether there's something there. He tends, you know, he has a very strong polemical kind of personality, and trying to, you know, to get through the polemical wheat to the chaff, some of these arguments he makes is can be maddening. But I do think so I urged him to try to produce a very, very careful and scholarly argument about this topic, and heavily referenced, balanced, looking at all the alternatives and the counter arguments. And I haven't seen that yet, quite honestly. But I think that's something that we all need to do when we're trying to make sense of this evidence.
Right.
So as far as the piece, you're an economist in training, is that right?
That's right. In fact, my initial work was in econometrics, which is applying economic theory to statistical work. So that's what gave me sort of the easy lead in to working on the question of insider trading. I mean, for other people, they can sort of just jump on news reports, but I was trying to do it in this kind of reflective of my own scientific background.
Interesting. So what's your take on the people who have argued that there's a link between serious economic problems at the macro level in this country and in the world, and the events of 9/11, specifically Mike Rupert and his peak oil hypothesis that where the world economy is about to go into a permanent tailspin, and then other perhaps less extreme arguments that 9/11 may have been partly motivated by an economic crisis?
I guess I'm not really ready to answer that.
Okay.
I have taught and I will be teaching again an environmental economics course in which the emphasis really was on oil depletion and peak oil and so forth and so on. I certainly can think that that's a major element of what's going on, but there's so many possibilities of why 9/11 would be beneficial to an administration like the Bush administration that I don't know if I'd want to reduce it to any one thing.
Well, that's a good point. There's certainly more than enough motives to go around between Silverstein raking in billions of dollars and the military getting its budget doubled overnight, so-called preemptive wars of aggression getting launched, and on and on and on. Well, hey, it's been a great conversation. Paul Zaremka, I appreciate your coming on as the first ever guest on the new weekend edition of Truth Jihad Radio. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Paul Zaremka, editor of The Hidden History of 9/11. Brand new paperback edition out. You can get it for not much over $15, or a little under $15 on Amazon. Used to be insanely expensive. It's weighed in gold. We'll be back in the next hour with another contributor to that volume. It's Brian Sachs, the author of a wonderful brief and hard-hitting critique of the 9/11 Commission report. So stick around. We'll be right back.